10 months of bargaining with them. The key issues for us, including making sure that we have a student-centered budget that is focused on academics, that we have working conditions that provide for faculty stability, and that we're protecting the voice of educators in the classroom and our participation in the university decisions.
Some of the issues are very similar from recent Portland public school negotiations.
We just want to make sure that academic freedom is protected as it has been throughout the history of higher education as a very important way by which academics and researchers can be really free to pursue ideas, trains of thought, research without any sort of meddling. That has traditionally been protected through the tenure system in higher education, and that is something that is most definitely being eroded. You have now here at PSU something like more than 50% of credit hours are being taught by instructors who are on short-term contracts. These are not tenured faculty, so they don't have some of the means by which those protections have been traditionally provided.
PSU and PPS educators both complain of top-heavy spending priorities and use the phrase student-centered budget.
With the nature of higher education increasingly being paid for by students rather than the state because of the decline in state funding, we really believe that the budget should be focused on students and academics because they're the ones that are footing the bill. And so we want to make sure that the budget that's presented and that we use here at this institution is really oriented towards academics and not extraneous things such as sports or some of the properties such as the hotel that the university owns and operates. Those are things that need to, kind of be put on the side as we kind of reorient our focus towards academics and towards students at this institution.
Salaries are typically an issue in labor talks, and that is important here as well.
Absolutely. The working conditions of the faculty here are an issue, and they're an issue because they are the things that really determine the learning conditions that we're able to provide as faculty to students in the classroom. So given the administration's own statistics, our salaries are the lowest in our group of 19 comparator institutions. And those issues with the kind of lack of stability of long-term renewable contracts creates conditions in which faculty aren't able to stick around. And so I have heard from colleagues stories of being approached by students for a recommendation for a class that they had with them outside of the department. And when they asked the student, well, shouldn't someone in your department give you that recommendation? They said that there was no one left there to give it to them, either because their class sizes were too big or because those faculty left as they pursued better options that were more competitive.
Professors have never walked out at an Oregon State University, and PSU professors seem ready.
I think that whenever we're involved in a situation like this, it's about priorities. And we believe that the priority should be on the students, on the academics. And we believe that there are certain core things related to the working conditions of faculty that have to be met in order to provide for the kinds of exceptional and quality higher education that we are oriented to providing. And we are absolutely willing to do whatever it takes to provide for quality higher education for our students. I mean, that's why we're here. We're here because we love working with students. We love doing research. We love contributing to our communities in those ways. And we need to stand up and fight for the future of PSU. And so we're absolutely willing to do what it takes in order to accomplish that.
That was PSU Professor David Osborne. His labor union is hosting a rally at PSU this Thursday at 11 a.m. You're invited. And I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The Western Regional Advocacy Project, WRAP, sponsor of the Homeless Bill of Rights, held a community gathering today. Jimmy Tardy caught up with WRAP Executive Director Paul Bowden at Portland's Sisters of the Road, where they talked about the Homeless Bill of Rights and community organizing.
The solution to homelessness is housing. Now, the racism and classism that created the situation that we're in, we got to address. But if we want to address homelessness, meaning without a house, then we have to get that money back, the $54 billion a year. And you do that, you extrapolate that over 30 years, we're talking a lot of money that used to be available for developing and maintaining affordable housing that is gone, long gone. And you're not going to case manage poor people into housing when you have no housing to case manage us into. So I would say that's one example. Another example is the proliferation of sidewalk ordinances. Here, I think it's called sidewalk management, safer cities in LA, quality of life laws in San Francisco, whatever you want to call them. They're all over the country, and the top three issues that homeless people have identified that they're being arrested and cited for, given tickets for, is sleeping, loitering, standing still, and sitting on a sidewalk. So when you say to a group of individuals that don't have housing that you can't sleep, sit, or stand in our community, you have implemented a sundown town. You have implemented the ugly laws and the anti-Oki laws and the Jim Crow laws that we've done before and we've seen before. You have reincarnated those type of policing and that type of local enforcement. You know, they all have target populations that these laws get aimed at. Right now, it's homeless people. But it's been other people in the past, and it'll be other people in the future if we can't stop this once and for all and say to local governments, you have abused your authority, so you no longer have the legal right to create and enforce laws that are specifically aimed at getting rid of people that you want to get rid of. Because why is sleeping, sitting, or standing considered a crime? And who but homeless and poor people would ever find themselves in a situation where they're in jail because they were sleeping, standing, or sitting? We all know that individually we're not going to have the power to stop it. And we have to band our resources, our skills. You know, some of us are good at some stuff. Some of us are good at other stuff. But when we all come together, it means we're all good at all of it. And we have to band those skills together and those resources together and join together to fight it and stop it once and for all. We call it accountable organizing. Like, if you're going to say we, if you're going to say we're representing, then you have to be able to back up and document who it is you're representing. You have to hold yourself accountable to using the word we. And so we feel that too many poor people and too many homeless people have self-identified leaders that go around talking on behalf of poor and homeless people. There's 13 national homeless groups in Washington, D.C., all claiming to rep the interests of homeless people. That's asinine. I see it as a dynamic that when it comes to poor people in general, when it comes to homeless people in specifics, that you don't have to be accountable to the poor and homeless people. You have to be accountable to the foundations that fund you and to the government entities that you're trying to meet with so that you maintain access to that entity. So too often groups are not willing to take on the pivotal issues that are real and constant in the lives of poor people and the lives of homeless people because they don't want to lose access to the people in power. And so when your master becomes the people in power, you're going to give up on credible representation of the people that are poor and don't have any power. Our interest and our responsibility is to make sure the message we're putting out resonates with a bunch of, and you're never going to resonate with everybody, but at least by doing documented street outreach and finding the common threads and being able to identify 81% arrested for sleeping, then we know that the police enforcement of people based on the fact that they're sleeping is a real, legitimate, credible argument and a legitimate campaign for us to base our work off of, and that it's going to resonate in the experience of individuals that are homeless or people that know other homeless people that got busted for that or got arrested for that or got hassled for loitering. That even if they don't individually, personally agree with everything we're saying, they know other people that do. And they know that the issues that we're talking about and that we're highlighting as priority issues is connected to their community, whether it's connected to them individually or not. But if we do it right, there's enough people where they'll say, that's right, about time. And we have no idea how many times we've heard from families and from community groups, we've been trying to say that for years, and no one will listen to us. Well, now there's a place they can plug into that will listen and will join their voices and their concerns with other groups that have the same voices and the same concerns and build a campaign for justice, not just to end homelessness, but to attack the root causes of homelessness, which is racism, classism, and neoliberal economic policies. I mean, that's what created this. And if we ever want to get real about addressing it, we need to address it at its core issues. And there's a direct cause and effect to massive cuts to residential treatment for indigent mentally ill people and the number of mentally ill people in our jails. There's a direct connect between the massive cuts to affordable housing funding and the numbers of kids that are in public school every day that don't have a home to go to that night. So those are the issues that drive us. Maybe it's not just that we're all screwed up or our DNA changed in the early 80s where we thought sleeping outside was the way to go. Because I know that didn't happen. I know that we didn't all of a sudden decide, man, I'm tired of this living in a house. I want to go sleep in a street. That didn't freaking happen.
The last of three megaload shipments of tar sands equipment has hit a snag in Idaho and is currently sitting on the side of the highway. The megaload transport carrying 800,000 pounds of industrial equipment to be used for the Alberta tar sands pipeline experienced weather-related delays over the weekend in Idaho. Activists affiliated with Wild Idaho Rising Tide said they're doing their best to remain ready to demonstrate their opposition on Tuesday night when the load is expected to be back on the move north to Canada. Area organizer Helen Yost discussed both the delay and the hazardous road conditions incurred by the transport with KABU reporter Robin Ryan.
I'm talking with Helen Yost, and she is an organizer with Wild Idaho Rising Tide. You guys have had a pretty busy weekend.
We have indeed. There were five protests over the weekend in five different towns all across southern Idaho against tar sands transports that are making their way up to Alberta to be part of the whole tar sands mining project that various oil companies are pursuing.
This transport is otherwise known as the Megaload. Can you tell me where the Megaload is right now?
Yeah, it's actually parked a few miles east of Butte City, and that's about 60, 65 miles northwest of Idaho Falls. It's getting ready to go up the Lemhi Valley toward Salmon and then cross over 7,000-foot Lost Trail Pass into Montana and eventually protests in Missoula, Montana.
There's a crowd waiting for them there.
Oh, yeah. There'll be quite a crowd waiting for them, mostly organized by Indian People's Action, and likely there will also be a direct action training workshop sometime this weekend for people to learn all those skills and be prepared in advance for actual confrontations with these haulers for big oil companies.
Is the Megaload following the travel plans that it had?
Well, we saw it run into some troubles this weekend. In several instances, we saw wheels under this 800,000-pound transport going off the pavement. We wonder what that's doing to publicly financed road infrastructure. And it pulled all kinds of other situations that seemed dangerous, getting on an interstate on an off-ramp and crossing over in between the four lanes of Interstate 84 near Mountain Home by using one of these emergency turnaround areas and just coming seriously close to people standing just right on the curb and that not seeming to be an issue for them. So we figure they're wrecking public infrastructure and endangering folks and definitely clogging two-lane roads with their 27-foot-wide width all along very dark roadways in the middle of the night. So it's a dangerous situation. In many instances, there's plenty of flashing lights with the usually dozen or two dozen vehicle convoys that go with these megaloads. It can be a very confusing experience coming up on this circus and not really knowing if you're supposed to go around or wait. So, yeah, it's dangerous for people all the way around, especially when it gets to Canada and wrecks the land, air, and water of First Nations people's land and pollutes the atmosphere to the point that it could make global climate change a done deal.
So when does the megaload expect to be on the move again?
Well, we heard, although we're going to check back with Idaho State Police, that the load is not running tonight. It didn't run last night because of storms coming through the Northern Rockies, but we suspect it might be up and running again on Tuesday. That puts the load going through Missoula the following Monday. Next Monday, March 3rd, if folks want to come there and protest. We have been mobilizing folks in small towns all across southern Idaho to rise up against this load as it comes through. And we're very, very pleased that people have been doing exactly that, albeit in small numbers. Every protest has more and more people at it.
I know your organization is mobilized in protest of all of the shipments. This is number three, if I'm counting correctly. Can you describe the reaction of your group to the news that the megaload was not going to be moving as scheduled?
Well, it's very difficult to organize protests when you don't know exactly when the load's going to move, and sometimes it's even hard to pinpoint where exactly it is. It seems that some of the agencies in charge, specifically the Idaho Transportation Department, at least in Idaho, and of course the other state transportation departments in Oregon and Montana, and the various state police departments don't really want to make that information publicly available as to where and when the loads are going, which is unfortunate because these are dangerous projects on public roads and people should know these things are on the road before they plan their travel. Sometimes we're elated to have that information and be able to organize folks, and other times it's a letdown when we think the loads are going to go and then they don't.
I've been talking with Helen Yost of Wild Idaho Rising Tide. For more information, you can visit their website at wildidahorisingtide.org. For KBOO News, I'm Robin Ryan.
In the Oregon State Legislature today, the House Education Committee pushed through a bill on Native American mascots in schools. The bill is a compromise that will allow some schools to retain their mascots after consultation with tribal leaders after a 2012 decision by the State Education Board to ban Native American mascots. Here's some of the testimony from today's committee hearing.
My name is Michael Mason. For the record, I reside in Portland. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Sletes. I want to say they are in support of this bill, of course, supported the bill last year, and are acceptable to the compromise, primarily because it does send the Board of Education back to have consultation with all the nine federally recognized tribes. That was a critical point. And I just want to make the point that 3 minutes of testimony is not consultation. There needs to be a longer discussion. And that will happen under this bill. And that's very important. It's not just important for mascots. It's important to resume a conversation about curriculum that's very important.
My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. We are here in full support of Senate Bill 1509. As you heard from Michael, we're very proud of the government-to-government process. We're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish along with the state in working on things like deletion of squaw language from Oregon geographic board names, working on illegally held archaeological objects, working on state-certified tribal police officers, and with last session, the passage of this bill to allow school districts and tribes to work together towards an agreement to do the right thing when it comes to imagery and the mascot issue. So we thank you very much for your time. We'll be brief. I know you want to hear from folks. But what we'd like to really focus on today is the fact that we were able to sit down with the governor's office, go through something that we both could agree with, something that'll be representative of all nine federally recognized tribes, help answer the questions on the front end, so when these issues happen, tribes and school districts automatically can start to have those discussions.
My name is Sam Sachs, and I am a human rights commissioner for the city of Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to speak to you, Chair, members of the committee, today about Senate Bill 1509. 2005-2006, two students, Shea Butler, Louis Whitebear, came forward to the Board of Education. They expressed that they felt discriminated against, harassed, and bullied based on the Native American mascots that were represented at their schools and other schools traveling to and from. They brought this issue to the Board of Education. There was a thorough process that was done. There was a research, 39-page research paper that was presented to some of you. I think hopefully all of you have read it. And inside that research, as you've stated, the American Psychological Institute, the American Sociological Institute, the Anti-Defamation League, the Civil Rights Commission in 1964, the ACLU, the NAACP, lists of human rights, civil rights organizations have called for the elimination of Native American mascots. Nowhere in any of their calls, nowhere in the 39-page report does it state appropriate use of mascots. And let's just say that this is about race-based mascots. It's not just Native American mascots. We're talking about pride and honor. I'm Jewish. Been Jewish my whole life. Born, live, gonna die Jew. Proud as anybody. I would never buy off on any school having a Jewish mascot, whether I'm okay with it or not, because it affects so many other people and so many other students, and I'm not okay with it. Nor would anybody buy off on the Beaverton Blacks, the Lake Oswego Latinos, any of that.
Thank you very much. Any brief questions for Mr. Sachs? Huffman, Representative Huffman.
A lot of this is a local control issue. One size does not fit all. I'm offended by reports saying that every school that has a Native American mascot is being discriminatory. I had 8 kids in the Dallas High School. Representative Fagan went there. I cannot tell you in my 30 years in that community of one instance where a Native American student felt diminished, picked on. It's an honor thing in the Dalles, and I'm offended that people on the State Board of Education, and I said this last year in the hearing, don't come into my community and tell us what to do when it's working fine. We get along great with the Warm Springs Tribe and the Yakima Tribe, and there are no problems. So don't quote reports and tell me that there are.
That was testimony from today's committee hearing in Salem on a bill involving Native American mascots in Oregon schools.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with David Speedy with the Carnegie Council for International Affairs. He'll speak with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the current situation in Ukraine after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30 on Prison Pipeline, we hear excerpts from a conference on women in prison. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Expect occasional rain this evening with an overnight low around 38. Tomorrow will be partly sunny with a high of 50. In today's radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland, Powell Butte measures 28 CPM, Tenino measures 33 CPM, and Olympia, Washington, 27 counts per minute. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
Egypt's Prime Minister Haslem al-Beblawi announced the resignation of his government earlier today. The Egyptian military had installed Beblawi last July after ousting President Mohamed Morsi, who is currently on trial in the Egyptian capital. Beblawi's interim government brutally suppressed Morsi supporters and oversaw the worst mass killings in modern Egypt. The frontrunner to take over Egypt's government is said to be military leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who has indicated he may stand for election.
It's 5:28. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The uber rich are full of ideas. Not, unfortunately, ideas to help humanity, but to help themselves grab more money and power at our expense. Take Tom Perkins. He's one of a growing number of the put-upon rich. Billionaires who've grabbed a fabulous fortune by hook or crook, but now complain that they are victims of a rising tide of hatred. Excuse me, Tom, but the words billionaire and victim are not a natural pairing. Yet, even though he candidly concedes that he lives a life of vulgar excess, Perkins wrote a sob story letter in January to the Wall Street Journal pleading for relief from the, quote, war on the American 1%, namely the rich. He was roundly ridiculed for that, but he's since come back with a pragmatic idea for redressing the grievous plight of the put-upon 1%ers. What's needed, he explained, is a slight tweaking of America's democratic election system. The Tom Perkins system, he lectured, is you don't get to vote unless you pay a dollar of taxes. But what I really think is it should be like a corporation. You pay $1 million in taxes, you get 1 million votes. How's that? Gosh, so much vanity and ignorance crammed into only three sentences. Apparently, no one has informed Tom that poor people pay a larger percentage of their income in various taxes than do privileged tax evaders like him. Nor does he seem aware that a democratic government cannot be anything like a corporation, for government must serve the whole public, while a corporation is an autocratic hierarchy that serves only a few. And golly, Tom, why should you and all of your billionaire buddies get anything special, like extra votes, just for paying taxes? What you get in return for taxes is what we all get, civilization. This is Jim Hightower saying, I thought I would write to Tom about his plan, but then I realized I don't know how to spell. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
In California, five children have been stricken with polio-like symptoms, even though all tested negative for polio and all had been vaccinated. At this time, there is no known cure for the unknown disease, according to Stanford University experts. Three of the five children had respiratory illness prior to their suffering paralysis. While polio has been largely wiped out across the globe as a result of the vaccine introduced in the 1950s, small outbreaks have occurred in Pakistan, Nigeria, and Afghanistan. The children showed similar symptoms involving sudden loss of movement in one or more limbs with paralysis setting in within 2 days. Doctors said that while the symptom is extremely rare, parents should contact a doctor immediately if their child shows signs of paralysis.
25 miles of the Mississippi River, 30 miles west of New Orleans, have been closed after an oil spill on Saturday. The spill was caused by the collision of two ships, the Lindsay Ann Erickson and the Hannah Settun, under foggy nighttime conditions. The Hannah Settun was pushing two barges transporting light crude oil, which spilled into the Mississippi after the crash. The Coast Guard reports that over 31,000 gallons of oil were spilled. No humans were injured in the crash. Downriver drinking water sources on the Mississippi have been closed as a precautionary measure. An investigation is underway to determine the cause of the crash.
A new solar panel developed by IBM engineers could vastly increase the power capacity provided by solar power. The company claims that their high-concentration photovoltaic thermal system can concentrate the power of 2,000 suns. The heat is absorbed into hundreds of tiny solar cells called photovoltaic chips. These gather the energy and are then cooled by microchanneled water, which is why they are safely able to concentrate such large amounts of solar energy. The water can then be used for other purposes, and the electricity generated by the process would be substantial. According to Greenpeace, this technology can establish itself as the third largest player in sustainable power generation industry. A study published in 2009 predicted that solar power could supply all the world's energy needs with minimal space. Greenpeace estimates that it would take only 2% of the Sahara Desert's land area to supply the entire planet's electricity needs.
A weed killer known as Roundup, produced by Monsanto, could soon lead to the extinction of the monarch butterfly, according to a report by the Natural Resources Defense Council. The herbicide threatens the existence of the monarch butterfly by killing milkweed plants near the genetically modified corn and soy crops in the Midwest. The monarch migrates annually from Canada to Mexico. On the migration of the monarch, each butterfly only lives a few weeks in the summer, and the milkweed is the sole source of food for the monarch larvae. It takes several generations of monarchs to make the migration to their wintering spot in Mexico and then back to Canada. The latest tally of the monarchs wintering in Mexico has them at only 10% of their recent annual average. A petition on behalf of the monarchs was filed with the Environmental Protection Agency by the National Resources Defense Council. The petition is asking the EPA to conduct urgent review of the rules for the use of the weed killer. The petition also asks for herbicide-free zones to be created in and around the farmers' fields and that highway and power line rights-of-way be herbicide-free. The petition is urging the EPA to start the review within 30 days and finish within 6 months.
The French military incursion into Central African Republic could end up lasting much longer than anticipated, according to new reports from the ground. Initial French military reports predicted 6 months would be enough to quell the sectarian conflict between Christians and Muslims when forces were deployed 3 months ago. But now, the French government says that they anticipate their soldiers to remain in place for at least a year. The conflict began in March when Muslim Salika rebels seized power in the majority Christian country. Over 1 million people have been displaced and tens of thousands killed, according to Human Rights Watch. The head of the French Army Support Association has called for an immediate surge in the French deployment for up to 5,000 troops, which he claims will help break the cycle of violence. The French Parliament would need to approve a mission extension, and the UN says it would take up to 6 months for an international coalition to step in to assist the French troops.
Yesterday, a lawsuit against the New York Police Department was dismissed by a federal judge in New Jersey. The lawsuit alleged that a special section of the NYPD surveyed members of the Muslim community in New York City and New Jersey over the course of several years. Muslim advocates say that the ruling is unconstitutional. KBOO reporter Ryan Katz has more.
A federal judge ruled that the New York Police Department's secret spying on Muslims in schools, restaurants, and mosques is perfectly legal. U.S. District Judge William Martini tossed out the lawsuit, which was brought against the police department by a group of New Jersey-based Muslims. Judge Martini said that the media's exposure of the surveillance by the New York Police Department was the real harm, rather than the surveillance itself. Quote, none of the plaintiff's injuries arose until after the Associated Press released unredacted confidential New York Police Department documents and articles expressing its own interpretation of those documents. Ghadir Abbas, a staff attorney for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, explained it this way.
In August 2011, the Associated Press reported about the existence of what was called a demographics unit inside the NYPD police department that was purpose-built to spy on the Muslim community, not only in New York City, not only in New Jersey, but all across up and down the East Coast. And this spying program decided to spend taxpayer dollars infiltrating nefarious things such as Muslim students going on camping trips where an informant would take note of how many times a day people prayed. They also did things like track all the Muslim establishments in Newark, New Jersey, and would have what they referred to as mosque crawlers flood New York City's mosques to monitor sermons.
The lawsuit cited 20 mosques, 14 restaurants, 11 retail stores, 2 grade schools, and 2 Muslim student associations in New Jersey, which were the sites of the supposed New York Police Department surveillance. And when determining which communities to target, the NYPD had identified, quote, ancestries of interest, which indicated special areas for investigation. Mr. Abbas says that actions like these are indicators of institutional racism.
I mean, it really is the mentality that would implement a program that spies on the Muslim community assumes that the Muslim community is somehow predisposed to acts of political violence. And that's actually factually untrue. The Muslim community has unfortunately been presumed guilty as a community, and that has led to these really despicable, unconstitutional consequences.
According to Abbas, the NYPD program has its roots in a decision made by a judge in the wake of September 11th.
Right after September 11th, NYPD went back to court to get those restrictions lifted. And unfortunately, a judge did say that September 11th ushers in a new world. And we see right after those restrictions were lifted, we get NYPD going back to its old ways of spying on people that are not suspected of criminal wrongdoing.
The sad part about this case is that court documents show that this program has not led to a single conviction. Here's Abbas.
The NYPD's own officials admit that their invasive, expensive, pervasive spying on the Muslim community has not yielded a single charge a single conviction of any crime.
Meanwhile, the plaintiffs, which include an Iraq War veteran and the former principal of a Muslim girls' grade school, vowed to appeal the decision. With KBU News, this is Ryan Katz.
And now, the latest developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, February 24, 2014. Israeli troops attack West Bank village, injuring a civilian. Meanwhile, homemade shells fired from Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian civilian was shot and injured by Israeli troops' gunfire during clashes which erupted between invading troops and villagers of Taqwa, east of the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. Khalaf Abu Mfarrih, 31, was shot in the foot with a live bullet during clashes which erupted in the vicinity of a local school. Medical sources announced that Abu Mfarrih was given first aid at the scene and later transferred to hospital for treatment, where his condition was described as stable. Elsewhere, Israeli forces and civil administration officers issued demolition and eviction orders to 40 Palestinian families in East Jerusalem. Local sources said that the civil administration officers delivered the orders to families in the Jebel al-Baba neighborhood of Al-Izariya. The families, who mainly live in steel structures and tents, must leave their homes by March 3rd, according to the orders. Around 300 Palestinian Bedouins from Jehalin live in 22 homes made of steel, wood, tin, board, as well as tents. Israel has been trying to displace the community of Jebel al-Baba to expand the nearby settlement of Ma'ale Adumim since the 1990s. In the 1950s, the Al-Jahalin community was forcibly displaced from its ancestral home in the Negev Desert and resettled east of Jerusalem. Last week, Israeli forces bulldozed five steel structures belonging to the Bedouins of Al-Jahalin community in Al-Izariya, leaving 55 people homeless. In other news, Israeli sources announced that at least two homemade shells were fired from Gaza Strip and landed in Ashkelon Regional Council, just across the borders. No injuries or damages were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 24th, 2014 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bamoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the Afghan army received warnings from the Taliban 3 weeks before an ambush which killed 20 soldiers, according to the BBC. The attack took place at a checkpoint in Kunar province, close to the border with Pakistan, on Sunday. Gaping holes in Afghanistan's healthcare system are being obscured by misleading narratives of success ahead of the international troop withdrawal in 2014, an aid organization warns. Afghanistan's Taliban said Sunday it has suspended talks to exchange a U.S. sergeant for five senior Taliban prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. One of the four options President Obama is considering for U.S. military presence in Afghanistan beyond this year would leave behind 3,000 troops based in Kabul and at the American installation at Bagram, U.S. officials said. Military commanders have recommended 10,000 troops with more installations across the country.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has signed into law a bill which outlaws homosexuality. Under the law, those found guilty of, quote, aggravated homosexuality, which includes homosexual sex, incest, sex with a minor, could face life imprisonment. Those found guilty of, quote, the offense of homosexuality, defined as gay sex, could be sentenced up to 7 years in prison. Museveni signed the bill despite strong objections from Western states, including the U.S., the Netherlands, Denmark, and Norway. Here's a clip from the press conference in which a journalist asked Museveni to respond to the criticism of the law.
Many in the international community are saying that by your signing of this bill, you're taking Uganda a step backwards, that you are not protecting the freedoms and the rights and the choices of the Ugandan people. So how do you respond to that? And specifically, President Obama has said he was deeply disappointed by Uganda's move and says that it would complicate U.S.-Uganda relations. I've listened to everything that you've said in the statement. So how would you respond to that? And does it worry you? And have you spoken directly to President Obama about this?
Well, we have been disappointed for a long time by the conduct of the West, the way you conduct yourselves there. But we just keep quiet. We just see how you do things, how the families, how they are organized, in all these things. We see them, we keep quiet. We never comment because it's not our country. Maybe you like it. So, since there's now an attempt at social imperialism to impose social values of one group on our society, then our disappointment is now exacerbated.
That was Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni defending his decision to sign an anti-gay bill into law. Right-wing evangelical Christian groups have been linked to the anti-gay legislation in Uganda and around the world. Oregon's Scott Lively, who helped enact the state's constitutional gay marriage ban, has traveled widely, including to Uganda, promoting anti-gay legislation. Lively criticized the Ugandan bill as overly harsh, saying Russia's ban of, quote, homosexual propaganda is more along the lines of what he sees as sensible policy. Lively's organization, the Oregon Citizens Alliance, introduced a ballot measure in Oregon in 1992 asking the public to declare homosexuality, quote, abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. The measure failed to pass, with 56% of Oregon voters opposed and 43% in favor. Lively was charged with international crimes against humanity last year for his support of previous Ugandan anti-gay bill, which would have sought the death penalty for gays. Currently, 38 African countries have laws against homosexuality. Nigeria, which signed similar legislation in January, has seen a rise in mob violence directed at people suspected of being gay. Last week, in two separate cities, mobs dragged men out of their homes and paraded them around the streets naked while beating and humiliating them, then handed them over to police for more beatings and imprisonment.
In the United States, the state of Arizona is on the verge of enacting a law that would allow private businesses to refuse service to gays and lesbians as long as they cite religious opposition to homosexuality as a reason. The bill was passed by the Arizona House on a 33-27 vote last Thursday and needs the signature of Arizona Governor Jan Brewer to become law. Brewer, speaking about similar legislation she vetoed last year, said, "I think anybody that owns a business can choose who they work with or who they don't work with," continuing that she thinks that that decision should not necessarily be statutory. Protesters gathered outside the governor's office last Friday. Similar bills have failed in Idaho and Kansas, while one is under consideration in Utah. Proponents of the bill said that they are to preserve religious freedom, while opponents of the bill say that they are tantamount to Jim Crow-era separate but equal laws, which codified segregation as African Americans and whites. The issue has been pressed in Oregon, spurred by a Gresham bakery that refused service to a lesbian couple and has since come under investigation by the State Department of Justice and ended up declaring bankruptcy after losing too many customers due to the publicity around the incident. Oregon voters will likely see a ballot measure on November's ballot with language similar to Arizona's legislation. The Oregon Family Council a Christian advocacy group which is pushing the ballot measure in Oregon, says that forcing business owners to serve LGBT customers is similar to Jewish shop owners being forced to serve neo-Nazis. The group has faced widespread criticism for that comment.
In breaking news from the Ukraine, documents seized from the abandoned residence of deposed President Viktor Yanukovych reveal the president was planning a large military siege of the protest against his rule. Documents found by journalists at his abandoned estate have begun to be leaked online, with one showing that Yanukovych was planning a military intervention involving 22,000 police officers and 2,000 special forces police to surround the square, with snipers positioned to massacre the thousands assembled there. Yanukovych fled Kiev on Friday after special forces crackdown resulted in 88 deaths by gunfire as riot police attempted to retake the capital last week. Protests calling for Yanukovych's ouster had lasted for months, with protesters seizing a central square in the capital as well as government buildings. They were sparked by the president's failure to sign an economic accord with the European Union in favor of continued alignment with Russia. The right-wing nationalist Svoboda Party has since seized control of the government and impeached Yanukovych in parliament, and a warrant has been issued for his arrest. The whereabouts of Yanukovych are presently unknown, although unconfirmed reports circulated saying he'd been denied passage to Russia. We'll have more on Ukraine with an extended interview with David Speedy, director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, after the news.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Jennifer Kemp, and Mike Klepfer. The producer has been Joe Meyer. Special thanks to Jimmy Tardy. Our engineer is Mike Taklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Mike Klepfer.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I am speaking with David Speedy with the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. First off, I wonder if you could just talk about what is wrong with the impression that we've been given in the U.S. media about what's happening in the Ukraine?
Well, what is wrong is basically that the view that we're getting is from Kiev, the capital, from Maidan Square, which is, of course, important since Kiev is the capital, but it's not enough. It can be argued that there are, in fact, two Ukraines, east and west, and possibly even four Ukraines, east, west, the south, or Crimea, and Kiev itself. And the problem that stems from that is that the country is split almost down the middle along pro-European on the one hand, pro-Russian on the other. That's been reflected in recent elections and voting patterns has certainly been reflected in the reaction to the events of the last few days, where you do not have any kind of a monolithic or one-dimensional response to the crisis in Kiev. So the main problem is that we're only looking at it from a rather narrow and parochial point of view. You know, a tentative agreement was reached with the government about 48 hours ago, and literally the podium was seized from Klitschko by a demonstrator who said, "We're not adhering to this, are you with me?" And of course the crowd all roared their approval. So the question of whether the so-called, the people who put themselves in the position of being the negotiators with the Yanukovych government are the idea that they're in control of the situation is questionable at least.
There have been rumors of who is behind the coup now in the Ukraine, including some idea that the U.S. may have some involvement. Who do you think are some of the actors behind what we're seeing now?
Well, I think it really is much too early to tell. I would only point to the fact that what is of interest is that while the National Security Advisor sort of grimly warning Russia not to get involved, there's been a flood of Western European visitors and others who either have been to Kiev or are coming, including Lady Ashton, the British Foreign Secretary, and others who have said they're going to come to Kiev and try to help form the new national unity government, whatever that may be. Whereas Russians have not been seen, so I suppose a valid question to ask, who's interfering and what is the definition of interference? I think the idea of who's behind this or whether there's any sort of, nefarious outside influence, certainly there's no question that Ukraine has been, I think, put into the very invidious position of choosing between Russia and the West, as opposed to choosing what is right for Ukraine. It's sort of a pawn in a geopolitical game that's unfortunate. If I might just throw in the thought, by the way, that and the president has been guilty of this in the last few days, President Obama, Ukrainians do not like to be called the Ukraine. That goes back to the old Soviet days, where Ukraine was a province, essentially, of the Soviet Union. So they much prefer just Ukraine.
Well, how is it that that President Yanukovych is now on the run? I understand that he was, the parliament was told that he was leaving office, but I thought that in the government there was supposed to be a review of the case and a vote in order for the president to be removed from office.
Well, quite so. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that, like it or not, and we often don't like it, especially in countries of the former Soviet Union. In Ukraine, as in Russia, we have a leader who is a democratically elected leader. That is not to say that Yanukovych can be described as an effective or particularly representative leader. His shortcomings are pretty obvious. But the fact is, he was duly elected, and what has happened has essentially been an overthrow of an elected government, an elected president. His motives for leaving, I think, were probably quite simply fears for personal safety. What has been going on, and the what happened, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, after the so-called agreement was reached between the opposition leaders and the government, certainly, I'm sure. And I'm sure he's looking at other similar episodes in Egypt and elsewhere, where popular uprisings became popular and also violent. I think chapters still have to be written. Apparently, he is, the last I heard, most likely in Kharkov in the east, which is, of course, a stronghold of his party of regions. There are schisms within the party itself, so this really is a fraught, dangerous, and highly volatile situation.
What are the chances that the ultra-right nationalists might step in this void that's been left by Yanukovych?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think that harks back to what I said a few minutes ago about who are these people that we're seeing as sort of freedom fighters for a Western-oriented democratic Ukraine. There's no question I interviewed an American-based academic who's currently in Odessa in Crimea, and you know, he pointed to the fact that in the West, in Lviv, which is the heartland of the protest movement, that there are houses are being daubed with the words "Jews live here," in a way that's eerily reminiscent of the early 1940s when the fascist alliance was not at all unwelcome in the western part of what is now Ukraine. So Ukrainians have long memories, and people in the south and in Crimea and elsewhere that are more in the Russian camp remember these times, and there are ultra-right wing movements. There is one particular nationalist movement called Svoboda, which means freedom, which has, on the one hand, tried to distance itself from the ultra-right wing elements, but whose leader once was famously quoted as saying that Kiev is run by an alliance of Russians and Jews. So again, there's some sort of head-scratching items here that complicate the picture we're getting in the Western media.
And are there things that you think should be done to prevent that kind of right-wing nationalist tendency, or to address it?
Well, I think the way to defang that kind of movement is to marginalize it. And I think that the only way to do that, I think, and others have said this too, is essentially for the West and Russia somehow to come together. Both have an interest in Ukraine. Ukraine is a key country. In a sort of broad European context, I would argue that Russia is always a key country in a broad European context. It would be wonderful to see a Europe that embraces both Russia and Ukraine in a collegial membership way. Of course, we've never really seen Russia in that light in the 20-odd years since the end of the Cold War. But I think that in the interim crisis situation, it would be imperative for the West and the Russians to sit down together and really try to forge a genuine government that would be at least an interim situation to defuse the crisis of the moment, and to recognize that Ukraine's national interests lie in what is best for Ukraine and not in any sort of alliance with either or a zero-sum game between the West and Russia.
Thanks for the analysis of the situation in Ukraine right now. I've been speaking with David Speedy. He is the director of the U.S. Global Engagement Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Recently, the Portia Project hosted the Women in Prison Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School. Speakers covered many issues women face in prison and ideas for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline, February 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Car.
Yeah, it was kind of a POS, wasn't it?
It was such a junker. We were going to donate it to the radio station.
Oh, do they accept vehicle donations?
Yes, that was the plan, you goofball. We were going to donate it to KBOO, but no. Instead, what happens? We leave it in the stupid yard, and then Bigfoot comes.
Yeah, he took it off our hands.
Yeah, he took it. He took our car. It's not like we can deduct Grand Theft Sasquatch from our taxes. We could have taken it off on our taxes if we brought it to KBOO.
Don't let this happen to you. Donate your vehicle to KBOO Community Radio before Bigfoot steals it. For more information, call 877-526-6123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
The time is 6:03. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. This is Jamie Partridge, your host. Tonight we'll be listening to a discussion that took place a week ago at a fundraiser for the Portland Contingent to the Labor Notes Conference in Chicago, April 4th through 6th, led by labor journalist, author, and organizer Steve Early.
Let me just say that this latest book tries to draw on some of the case studies of successful local union rebuilding, both in telephone, in the Teamsters, in machinists, and a number of other unions. One of the things that Labor Notes, I think, has been best at staying the course at is this idea that union democracy and reform struggles are still really central to the project of revitalizing the labor movement. Understandably, some people have felt and even expressed the view that because we are so embattled, we're so encircled, we're so under siege, we really can't afford to have much debate and discussion, we can't really have contested elections, it's too divisive, it weakens us. And Labor Notes consistently has, with its allies in major union reform movements, the Teamsters and other unions over the year, I think demonstrated that union structure does matter. It does affect union functioning and effectiveness. If the rank and file is not engaged and involved, if people are not building cross-union formations of the sort that Amy just described, if people are not networking in groups like Jobs with Justice and Labor Notes, we're going to continue to lose ground. We're going to continue to suffer defeats, and we're not going to be able to go on the offensive in the way that we need to. You're in the Pacific Northwest. I'm sure people here follow very closely the terrible concession bargaining setbacks recently at Boeing. That's the downside of that story. The upside of that story is that we now have the first contested election for top officers in the International Association of Machinists in 50 years.